My name is Steve Bowbrook, and I'm chairing this session on web services. The only reason I'm here, because I've been in the industry, in the internet industry, so long, Danny and Dave now humour me, and they give me the kind of geek equivalent of a free bus pass. I get to do this every year. I don't have any good reason to be here. But these guys do, obviously. And I think we've got, given what we've been hearing all day about the emerging infrastructure of this interesting new era we're entering. I think what we're going to hear here is going to be very relevant and very interesting. Because these guys are all either building, specifying, or evangelizing for this new way of hooking together services online and showing us the way into their applications and the way to hook our applications together. It's going to be very, very interesting. I'm going to try and keep you guys strictly to time so that we've got enough time at the end for questions and answers. That means unless there's a real tidal wave of people desperate to ask questions in between presentations, I'll keep them all till the end. So don't forget your questions. Hang on to them, and we'll have at least 10 minutes or so, I hope, at the end for the questions. Okay, we're going to start now with Don Young, who is, apparently doesn't like to call himself this, but is an evangelist for web services at Amazon, and it's his job to get the developer community and the business community excited about plugging into Amazon's APIs around Europe. Go.
I'm going to pick the mic up. Can you hear me? My name is Don Young. I don't like the title evangelist because it always gives me images of John the Baptist. Something peculiar happened to him, which I don't want to happen to me. Second thing is Groundles, where we're going to run this has changed a little bit. I think the questions are at the end, but if you've got some pressing need, feel free to ask me in the middle. I will, of course, ignore you, but feel free anyway. How many people have seen me before or have heard of me? No one. Okay. I would just like to say, well, thank you. You've clearly been paying attention. How many people here use web services in general? And how many people know about or use Amazon Web Services? Well, that's not too bad a show. I presume most of you people using Amazon Web Services are affiliates, are you? That's an even better ratio. I'm used to quite a lot of affiliates, so there are quite a few of you in here playing around with Amazon Web Services, and hope you've seen the new release of 4, which came out about a week ago. I hope that's meeting some of your requirements. I'll race to my background because it's not particularly relevant, bear in mind the time we have. But the interesting thing to take from that is that I've been working with a number of companies throughout the birth of the internet. And what is interesting about this period of time is like we're going back to basics. The internet was successful because it was actually based on things that were open. The actual specs that made the internet were open, people could develop with those and create their own things. Then big business came in and tried to sort of steal it all for itself, and we reached sort of settings of the boom. Now it seems that we're actually going back to what made the internet what it was, and that we're starting to open up all these silos of information and make them available to people. And we've got a means, a mechanism of doing that, and that mechanism at the moment is web services. So, again, bearing in mind time constraints, so I won't go into too much depth about this, but the interesting thing is that there's quite a lot of information that is stored at Amazon. Not just the user information regarding books and CDs, but incidental information, information that people add in terms of Listmania, wish lists, Amazon happen to own the IMDb, which is all about movies. And if you go to that site, imdb.com, you'll find lots of reviews on actors and movies and things like that. All stuff that is actually quite useful if you're actually thinking about buying something, or even just recommending seeing your favourite movie to a friend, because typically the way that people look at acquiring something is they start to realise that it might be interesting to get this, and then they start to ask the next important question: where can I get it, and is it relevant? I.e., to do some sort of search. And a lot of this kind of information is available on Amazon, and you can actually get it through the web services. So you can actually start to, because there were some talks earlier on today about community sites, you can actually start to look at augmenting your community site by getting relevant information to that community, whether that then leads to you trying to make some financial gain out of that by directing them to places where they can purchase, or just providing information or tracking through the scenes or all the movies that Michael Caine has made and which ones were rated as his best one and things like that. So there's lots of social benefits to that kind of information. We are, of course, buzzword compliant, which is actually more important than just being the buzzword compliant. I was just saying that we support web services, but web services for us means supporting both REST and SOAP, which means that we support the URL approach to getting information, which is effectively what REST is. It's a way of being able to actually query an information source and get the information sent back. We can send that information back to you through any mechanism of choice, XML, HTML. The importance of you mentioning this, as I'll come to later, is that we have an interesting split of people who use REST and people who use SOAP. The Amazon Web Services, and why are we actually different from Amazon? Well, the fact of the matter is we're a wholly owned subsidiary of Amazon. We're an Amazon company. But we like to consider ourselves to be like the barbarians at the gate. I like that phrase because it makes me think of IBM back in the old days, when IBM was a safe place to be and everybody wanted to use IBM. But IBM was missing what was going on in the world as we started to move more towards and that kept what was then called open systems. The idea here is to actually acknowledge the fact that Amazon doesn't own all the brightest people in the world. Amazon doesn't have all the ideas. Amazon doesn't know all that can be done with its data. So if it makes that information available to the people out there on the internet, they can use it in new ways. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to actually make sure that people can actually get the information, combine it in new innovative ways, whether that's through community sites or building their own selling sites. We're trying to look at our affiliates. We're trying to provide a more stable mechanism for delivering information to the affiliates than was previously provided. We're looking at ways of enabling people to drive the development of their own sites, and we mean that by actually making their own sites profitable, because you can actually use the Amazon Web Services to gain information about Amazon products which you can then sell for your site. And the benefits of doing it through something like Web Services is you can then start to deploy your own policy. You can choose what you want to show. You can order organized searches to provide information that you think is relevant to your community. You can do things that you wouldn't get if you went to the Amazon main page, where it's all designed about a specific individual that Amazon sees in a peculiar way. You can see that individual or that community in a way that's more relevant to them, or certainly more relevant to the organization or the community that you're actually building. Just going to take you through some of the components. Now, the main component in Amazon Web Services is something called ECS, which is primarily what the affiliates use. This consists of things like the shopping cart, being able to do the search, get information on the book, and do high-level searches and low-level searches. The difference here is the type of information it brings back, or do browse node search. Browse node searching is similar to the concept of owning a catalogue and saying, I don't want to look at just music now, I want to go look at film or electronics, and that's the idea behind the browser and the search. The Amazon Web Services also consists of some interesting things as well. The Alexa Information Service. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar with Alexa, but Alexa is a company that actually monitors how the internet's used. So they're tracking the most frequently used URLs, and we've got a lot of information based on types of browser being used and things like that. So it's kind of information, or if you like, meta information about the internet that is often quite useful for people, where they build tracking information that they present on the site, and they talk about the change in internet demographics and things of that type. We're also featuring other web services other than the ECS. One here is the simple queue service. The idea behind that is to have a queue that allows you to have about 4,000 elements in it, and you can do whatever you want with it. If you search around the internet, you'll find that some people are using the queue to build rudimentary chat things, some people are using the queue as basically a huge internet stack where they pop information in and come back a couple of weeks later and pull things out and do things of that type. Some people are even using the queue to organize queries. So one of the restrictions we have on the web services, we restrict you to one query a second. Some people like the idea of using the queue, putting queries into the queue and having it come out of the queue in a particular sequence so that they can actually, in effect, get more complex types of queries.
2 minutes, Tom.
Okay. One of the other interesting APIs that we actually use is we actually have an API to go the other way. So instead of us just sending information out to you, we have an API based on fixed price selling that allows you to be able to send information back to Amazon. And one successful organization that's been using that have been some libraries. What they've been doing is instead of actually giving the books away or selling them at $50, they've been able to actually have the books listed on Amazon. The result being that the libraries often have a lot of unique books that they're just getting rid of for about $2 that you might pay £5 for. So the libraries make a lot more money. A lot of people are very happy because all of a sudden they can find books that they didn't think they could get without, you know, shopping around 1,000 jumble sales. So what we're offering here at Amazon, sorry to finish up, just trying to save some time, is we're trying to offer a whole set of web services that enable you not just to do commerce, but to actually be able to start to investigate and use aspects of the internet. They're available in a free way, there's no charge associated with that, and according to the rules inside, we're not expecting to be applying a charge to any of these web services. Just go to amazon.com/web services and have a look there, and if there's any questions you know, you feel in depth, come see me at the end of the session. Thanks.
Excellent.
At least some people have read Harry Potter recently. Okay.
So an old tutor of mine back in Queen's University in Belfast once said to me, I don't want virtual reality, I want virtual magic. There's no point in building a straight facsimile of what we can do in the real world in our computer systems. If you're in Ted Nelson's talk earlier, you know kind of what he's talking about. Why build stuff that puts out paper when we can do much more than that? So I'm going to talk about quite a big book that not very many people have read. So the European Constitution is, or the treaty to put forward the European Constitution is about 500 pages long, saying 22 languages, applying to 25 countries, affecting the lives of 500 million people. However, I would be surprised if more than about 5,000 people have actually read it. So last summer, I had an idea, actually just over a year ago, to take the European Constitution and make it annotatable, link the different language versions of it together so you could see what people were saying in France about a particular section versus England. We did this work from kind of the autumn through to the spring this year as a volunteer project. Some people who are here, Etienne, who's in the audience, helped out quite a lot. And we did some nice information architecture around it, more nice pin URLs. And we basically took what was a PDF, 500 page PDF, linked to on the impenetrable European Constitution site, if you've been there. It's very difficult to work out what's current, which site exists. They put up new sites seemingly every 3 to 4 months. They don't take down old sites. So if we put up one place, which Google can find, and find the Constitution. The most frequent people who come to Tokyo are people looking for bits of the Constitution. Most people read, like most things, it's probably 100 to 1 or more in terms of read versus comment on the site. So from this, we came up with an idea of a social document, which I'll explain. So, okay, so at Tokyo, in Tokyo, articles are grouped at the lowest level, so they're kind of like the leaves of the document. The structure of the document is a numerical section, so 3.1.4.2. Within that, there are a number of articles which represent the points of law being discussed. That's the lowest level of which makes any sense. It's about labour laws or about tourism policy. Through Tokyo, we were hoping to get people context to what they were reading. And this idea of a kind of marketplace metaphor. Big impenetrable documents like the Constitution are kind of like a market you've never been to. So markets are persistent. They are around in the same place in the city for a long period of time. But it's very difficult to know where's the decent store inside a market, you know, who's the good butcher, who's the good florist, what the social relationships are there. So if you turn up to the florist with fish from the fishmonger and they're in a fight, then you might not get very nice flowers. But you can find out what's going on inside that market by going and talking to the people who are there. Similarly, if you can talk to the other people who are reading the same document as you, by reading their comments, by seeing how they're tagging content, you can get an idea of what things are important to people. Through Tokyo, you can do cross-cultural comparisons, currently only in French and English, but you can look and see what people in France are looking at and what people in England are looking at. So you get a sense of the different cultural opinions on this important document. There's lots of future possibilities, but sadly, the French and the Dutch decision back in June sort of put this debate, took some of the wind out of the sails, so it's clear whether the European Constitution is going to be ratified in its current form. So from this idea, we've got an interesting concept, this idea of social documents. So I've got a definition of a social document. A social document encourages direct engagement with the content of the document. It provides the means for the discussion within itself, enabling people's commentary and placing it alongside the document on a section-by-section basis. So that sounds a bit like a blog, but these are published documents. They tend to be static. They tend not to create additional information. In this case, I'm not the person who wrote it. They Work For You, which is arguably a social document. It's one that does accrete over time, but They Work For You aren't the people who are publishing the content. They Work For You as the MP, as the Hansard annotatable project. So those reading the document can therefore read the content and the opinions of those reading before them. So it gives richer content not present in the original. So going back to this idea of creating virtual magic online. Okay, so what about something people will actually read? Well, Gutenberg has 10,000 books, more than that, I think 16,000 books. Basically all of the world's copyright-free literature prior to 1923. When copyright gets difficult in the US and the UK, it varies internationally, I think. All of these have a long lifespan, they have huge numbers of readers. If you look at the number of people who download Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, it's hundreds of thousands of people over a year. So there's a really rich context to explore here as well. Social, historical, geographic, political, who were the main political figures at the time, what was London like during that period. London's now 3-4 times the size it was in 1900. With this project, we're hoping to create a true social document. Take currently starting with Victorian London around about 1900 and regenerate the context in which those books were written and initially read. So who were the major figures at the time that feature in the books? What other books do they feature in? And the project's called Novel Context. So to do this, with Talk Euro, we put the entire European Constitution into a copy movable type and linked it to a copy media wiki. To do what we want to do with this literature project, Novel Context, movable type won't work. We want to do more than we can do with that. It's not just simple annotation, we want to connect books together. So what do we need? I think we need a new type of social software for content. There's lots of social software out there that supports independent people generating content, or people discussing content, or people collaboratively creating content. This is static content we want to add annotation to, add richness to. And I don't think there are products out there that support this kind of thing. So we need a document repository for literature. Now, there are lots of people out there doing this. You go to literature.org, and various other people repurposing Gutenberg and making it organized by author or pen. You can download bits of it, things like that. So they're essentially repurposing Gutenberg out of an FTP site into a website. Worthy stuff, but I think we can do more than that. So we're providing means for public annotation on these books. We're hoping to create these rich contextual relationships and pull in the other resources on the internet. So one of the inspirations behind this was, if I said the Arden Shakespeare, would people know what I was talking about? The Arden Shakespeare is the academic versions of the Shakespearean plays. It's the best quality annotated versions of a page of the folio and then a page full of annotations explaining the humor, explaining the social and political context of the plays when they were written 400 years ago. Looking back to Victorian London, most people's grandparents or great-grandparents were alive then. There's enough of this in our historic memory that we can start creating this on a public website for ourselves. So I'll give you a quick example of how this might work. You're reading a story with Sherlock Holmes in it, and you go to Maida Vale. You're not sure where Maida Vale is in London, so Maida Vale is linked. You click on the word Maida Vale, it takes you to a page that explains what Maida Vale is, and says other books written around that time Maida Vale appears. So you might go from an Arthur Conan Doyle story about Sherlock Holmes to an Ian Forster novel written around about the same time. You discover that these two places featured in the contemporary memory of the people who read the book in 1900, but reading the book on its own, you have no way of knowing that. As I said, we want to pull in, there are lots of other great resources on the internet about this. Victorian London, if you haven't been, is a great site covering the Victorian period. On Wikipedia, there's plenty of other stuff, although Wikipedia tends to be more contemporary.
2 minutes, yeah.
Okay. We want to create an open framework, because I don't want to build a website with friends where I have to put up all these books myself. I want to build a framework in which other people can take ownership of the book, put that book up. Building structured metadata, not just tag clouds, because we want to capture the relationship. So the Strand is a street, and it is within London, which is within the UK, rather than just tagging it with Strand or London or UK. I've worked out some use cases for three different types of people who I think we need. We need readers, annotators, and book curators. And then various different social services. So who else is interested in the book that you're looking at currently? To capture these relationships, we want to use topic maps. Topic maps are a nice kind of knowledge description tool that over the last 3 or 4 years have become more popular. They allow you to the classic example is Berlioz is a composer, so you're relating the idea of a composer being someone who creates music with a person called Berlioz. We want to support these topic maps by providing inline annotation and still support simple comments like, I like this paragraph, or I think the plot is good at this point, or whatever, plus linking to other resources around the place. We want volunteers to take on a book and set it up. We've got some models for how books work. So books tend to be comprised of chapters, which is fairly robust. This is the idea of the content being created and taken away from the structure of a published book. Chapters are still a valid way of representing that information. We have authors, chapters, title, year of publication, location the book is set, main characters, his information door. So, a quick summary of what we're doing. I think social collaboration is a growing phenomenon. We've got things like there's an openly annotatable Bible. Someone recently did CPAN's annotatable version. A friend of mine, James Stewart, on the United Nations Charter. They were, a few years, as I said, do hand sewed. This was inspired by Phil Guyford's work on Peep's Diary and Cal Ahmed's topic mapping work on Peep's Diary as well. It's building a semantic web for world's literature, starting in London, growing out throughout the rest of the UK and across Europe, following the grand tour that people did in 1900, following literary trends as they evolved over the years, and building an open topic map of the Victorian period. Last slide. Okay, so if anybody's interested, I'm looking for volunteers to help me build this. My email address is here, neagambell.com. For a website which was set up a few months ago, where I'm adding other instances of social documents and setting up a form to build this within. These ideas were helped a lot by Matt Biddulph, Louisa Heinrich, and Chris Sizemore. So, thank you very much.
Now, well, in the inevitable 2 minutes while we get set up, I'll tell you what Lee's going to tell you about. Lee's building hopefully many, probably thousands, I assume, applications on top of the backstage stuff that we were hearing about earlier on. His application brings together a wiki, and he's going to be tagging and tags for BBC News content, as far as I know. It's also apparently going to give us a history on Remix Media.
Okay.
It's best of taking
it. I don't want to. This is all studiously low tech, so I'm just going to talk with my own voice, if that's okay. If anyone has a problem hearing me, just let me know, and I'll revert to this old-fashioned microphone contraption here. Rather perversely, I'm not going to talk about anything particularly technical, but I am going to talk about one or two, I guess, political aspects of web services, and a reason why we're particularly excited about the promise of web services, and particularly the BBC Backstage project. So, web services obviously are a key part of the enablers for what people are describing as a remix culture. The idea that you can take content or information provided by somebody like the BBC or Amazon or Flickr or Delicious, and you can do your own thing with it. You can both reorganize it, relabel it, but also build your own applications and build your own uses for that content as well. So, web services, I think, are very exciting to me, more so than the whole open source phenomenon, because obviously open source requires you to be a developer in order to make any sense of it or to do much with it, whereas open services, I think, are a bit more accessible because they allow people to get a lot more involved. So, very exciting part of the whole kind of social software world. In essence, remixing is very good for users, and in particular for this idea of prosumers, because obviously you can get what you want, how you want it, in language and terms that mean something to you rather than to the BBC's editorial staff. You can apply your own organisational metaphors to how you structure the information, and at the end of the day, you can start to build your own experiences with other people's content and with other people's information, which I think is very exciting indeed. For providers, it also makes a great deal of sense because it starts to lower the overheads of providing the information. You no longer have to provide information in a kind of one-size-fits-all configuration, and I think that's very important. And as Flickr have shown, and Delicious have shown, and indeed Amazon have shown very ably, you can enable a dependent or a related market for products and services that build on your content. I think in the particular case of the BBC, this is very important indeed because it's part of revitalising the BBC's public service remit, which, from my point of view, is an excellent defence against attacks that are being made on the licence fee and people trying to change the shape of the BBC in the future. But I think most exciting of all is that this enables a different kind of relationship. We're no longer talking about the classic Leninist broadcast model, which is, you know, kind of unidirectional. It's information provided from here to there as the voice of truth. But what we're talking about is building a collaborative relationship with users. And I think that we're only just starting to begin to understand, and I think that will impact on all of our lives in a positive way. So what actually am I talking about? I mean, why does it matter that we can take information from the BBC and we can relabel it and we can recategorise it? Well, I mean, there are very obvious current examples, such as the word terrorist. You know, if the BBC were to take an editorial decision that I am a terrorist, then that can have a very big impact on my life. So I'd be very interested in taking the BBC's information about news, mixing it with other sources, and then applying my own tags or my own labels to that content as well. I put some silly words at the end of here, which is the idea of protection against hegemonic discourse. Basically, control of language is obviously a key part of political and social control in any polity. The greater the extent to which we can actually control our own language, control the terms that we use for something, the more control we have over our own content, our own interaction, and our own collaboration. And I think that's particularly important, although it may seem silly at this stage, applying political ideas to web services. It's also important if you think about how we communicate. Cognitive science tells us that in order to communicate, we need a shared situation, such as this room right now. We need a shared perception. Broadly speaking, we all have brains that are wired up in the same kind of way. And we need two more things. We need shared cognition, some sense of shared categories, so that when I say this is a wall or this is a door, you know what I'm talking about. And obviously, shared lexical and grammatical convention, so that when I say this is a wall, you understand what I'm talking about, you understand English, and you know what we're discussing. Now, if you think about this, the whole idea of shared cognition and shared categories is a very interesting one, because when the BBC was developing in its early days, obviously it did so in a different context. It had this kind of paternalistic attitude towards its users, and this notion that the BBC can define objectivity. So it will stake a position which is neutral between various points of view, and then it will project that out as something which is objective. Now, obviously that idea is no longer really a current idea. Nobody seriously believes that there is one interpretation of events, nor indeed that the BBC is the sole arbiter of truth. So we live in a diverse world, and that means that being able for us to all apply our own terms, our own organisation to what's going on is quite important. It's this kind of notion of intersubjectivity. So that's really where I see some of the exciting applications for web services fitting in. If, as a provider of information, I provide the information, some open APIs, some schemas for people to play with it, and I let people remix, relabel it, and even rebroadcast it, suiting their own needs, then for me, that marks a very, very important change in the media landscape, but also in the world of collaboration as a whole. And it's something that I'm particularly excited about. So that's why we were really interested to get kind of slightly peripherally involved in a couple of backstage prototypes. We've built one, which was this idea of social tagging for BBC News, and that's been interesting. It's gathered some useful feedback, and hopefully we'll do some work on that in the future. And we're just about to build another, which is this idea of mini wiki guides, and that's really one of the reasons I wanted to talk today, invite any ideas and contributions into that project. So, briefly, what we looked at with the social tagging of BBC News was really quite simple. It's fairly obvious. BBC News stories come out. The BBC's hierarchy for organising news stories is very, very limited, and extremely limiting in the way that you process that information. So we just built a simple tool that's online. I think it's bbctags.headshift.com, and you can tag a story, you can organise your own bookmarks of BBC stories by your own tags, and you can see how other people have tagged a story, and you can see what kind of stories they're bookmarking as well. So, you know, it's not rocket science, it's fairly simple stuff, and then on a tagged level, it integrates with external services like Flickr, Delicious, and I think Technorati as well. So here you can see just a couple of screenshots of what's going on. There's actually a better movie there, a little screencast. So you can see there's a list of tags. You click on Zimbabwe, you see stories tagged with Zimbabwe, related links from external services, and you can navigate around by tag in a fairly simple way. So I can click on podcasting on this podcasting for Zimbabwe story, find other stories, go back and add my own tags there using, you know, it's a simple interface thing, XML HTTP request to keep it fairly current. As I say, not rocket science, but we were very, very interested in that because I think for us it shows just one small seed of possibility for the potential to actually remix BBC content going forward in a way that makes a lot of sense. So we had some thoughts about that, and we thought, okay, well, another area that's interesting is the BBC's archive, because the BBC's archive is so huge and of such, you know, generally speaking, very, very high quality, that the BBC itself, or no individual in the BBC, really knows what's in it. You know, if I were to go there and say, okay, show me everything that you've ever done about diabetes or about migraines since you came into being, nobody could really tell you how to find that content. So we thought, well, you've got loads and loads of passionate users out there who are experts in a particular domain, or they have a particular area of interest. It may be Doctor Who, it may be migraine, it may be the Iraq War. Why don't we see how we can build on this tagging application to allow people to put together a little kind of guide to that subject area that they can then share with other people? And obviously, the chosen mode for doing that these days is something like a wiki. But what we're concerned to do is to keep it extremely simple in terms of the user experience and to focus it pretty much around BBC content because there's so much of it. So we're in the process of putting together another prototype which lets people go around and tag not just news stories but programme pages, information pages, really anything that's on the BBC co.uk domain. And then they can initiate one of these little mini wiki guides. So for example, you might put together your guide to Islamic science. And the contribution that has made to European civilization over the years. You can drop in tagged pages, you can kind of grab images from pages that you've tagged, and you can organise the guide according to your own views. So it doesn't need to be objective, because it's really about you and your point of view, not the BBC. And then when you're ready, publish that as a little mini-wiki, so that other people can come along, add their own perspective, maybe suggest some more links, add some more content in there. And perhaps also help you guard on the wiki, maintain it and develop it. And then the idea is that if we can get any guides which are of sufficiently high quality, then beyond the prototype, you might have a system of approval where the BBC approves a guide, and then it appears as a under search results or on a subject page as basically user-driven guides to a particular subject area. So that's something we're building now. We're kind of building it on top of the tagging application that we already put together. And it's not going to change the world, but for us, it's a very, very interesting way that we can start to kind of pick away at the porous membrane around the edges of our state broadcaster and utilise these extremely exciting and quite, relatively visionary services that they're now making available. And I think what we hope to learn from this is, A, something about how users engage with these kind of tools, i.e., not just geeks and techies, but normal civilians, if you like. And also, we'd like to see this applied more widely to people who provide content or information of a particular type, look at the modalities of opening that up for remixing by their audience or their users, so they can start to build that kind of collaborative relationship with their users rather than the old style broadcast relationship. So that was it, really. If anyone's got any thoughts on how to do that, then we'd welcome them. And also, we're advertising for a developer, so this, I thought, would be a fairly good place to mention that. And if you've got any questions, I think at the end, yeah, we can address them.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Right, motoring along. We're now going all grease monkey all the time for the last 20 minutes of the session. We're going to start with Simon Willison, who's going to give us a kind of an overview and a look at some applications of grease monkeys. And then we've got Rob McKinnon, who's going to give us some more specifics.
Really an example and
an example.
Go with it, maybe.
Yeah, all right, good. They're for sure, because they don't overlap too much.
We should. Okay.
Right, so while the analog RGB searching things happen, you know what you're doing over there, don't you?
Yeah, they should do.
We're about to overrun a few minutes, but apparently that's okay, as long as you're not all bored to death.
Oh, here we go.
Okay, my name is Simon Merson, and I'm a web technologies enthusiast, not just for this bus. And I'm going to be talking about GreaseMonkey, which is a Firefox extension, which I think pretty much embodies the spirit of remixing and hacking that this whole day has been about. Before I start, unfortunately, I need to start with a bit of a disclaimer. If you've been following the technical news this week, you might have heard that GreaseMonkey has, at least the version I'm going to be demonstrating, has a security hole you could drive a truck through. And I will be talking about that a bit. I can assure you that there's a version available at the moment which is secure but crippled and doesn't do as many interesting things. And there's a lot of work going on at the moment into producing a lovely, secure, exciting version, which should hopefully be out in the next few days. So this was really very poor timing. Before I can talk about GreaseMonkey, it's useful to talk about the predecessors. GreaseMonkey is going to be a combination of two pre-existing concepts. The first is bookmarklets. Now, bookmarklets, they're basically bookmarks, and they're supported by most modern browsers. They're bookmarks which, instead of containing a link, contain a little piece of JavaScript, and when you click the bookmark, the JavaScript gets executed in the scope of the current page. What that means is that you can create these little bookmarks which will do stuff to the site that you're looking at. So a classic example would be if you had, say, a site with fantastic content that you really enjoyed reading, but with a horrible garish pink background. You could write a bookmark which would zap the background. It would turn it to something less offensive for you. So you could read the content. And you can do an awful lot more with bookmarklets. You could do a whole lightning talk about those. The second concept is something called user style sheets, which again is something that's supported by modern browsers. A style sheet, it's a custom CSS file that you can load into your browser that overrides the style rules set by people on sites. So if, for example, you like reading larger text on web pages, you can add a rule to your user style sheet that increases the font size of every page that you visit. So these things are both well and good, but they both suffer from limitations. Bookmarklets, you have to click it every time you load a new page. And user style sheets are very coarse. The rules that you apply will apply to every page you visit. And you can only do the stuff that you can do with CSS, which is a lot, but it's not as powerful as JavaScript. And this is where GreaseMonkey comes in. The GreaseMonkey extension enables you to enables the creation and sharing of what we've called user scripts. A user script is kind of like a user style sheet, only it's a file full of JavaScript, which can be associated with every page you visit, or just certain pages on certain sites. So these scripts can do anything JavaScript can do, which hence the security problem, because some of the things JavaScript can do can be pretty scary. And it's very easy to share them. So you can create a user script that you like, and you can put it on the web, and anyone else with GreaseMonkey can install it, run it, and get the same benefits that you get from it. So this basically lets you customize the web one site at a time. Now, it's all well and good talking about this stuff, but it's much better just to show it in action. So I'll start with a very simple script that I wrote a few weeks ago, which... there's a script that customizes Wikipedia. I'm a huge fan of Wikipedia. I think it's one of the most important sites on the web. But the one thing that annoys me about it is the search box right down here, which the search box, you type a word and there you hit go, it'll go to the Wikipedia page matching that term. And I do that already. I type the URLs directly into the bar, so I'd much rather that it defaulted to searching. Plus, the Wikipedia search engine is one that they've built, and sometimes it's slow, and sometimes it's not working at all, and doesn't produce particularly good results. So, here we go. I've just turned on GreaseMonkey by clicking the little monkey. And if I refresh the page, watch the search box there. You'll see that when the page refreshes, dun dun dun, There we go. The two buttons have swapped place, and that's all my script does. It swaps the buttons over. But it also means that when you run a search, instead of the search running on Wikipedia, it runs on Google but limited to the Wikipedia site. So you get that slightly better search results. So that's an example of an extremely simple customization. Now let's look at something far more interesting. The Odeon, I don't know if Matthew Somerville's in the room. But if not, the Odeon.co.uk, the cinema site, the site for the cinema chain, for the last 3 years has been this horrible mess that only works in Internet Explorer. And they know it's a problem. They haven't really done anything to fix it. So I think a couple of years ago, Matthew Somerville, who was in a talk earlier, produced his own version of the Odeon site. He created a script that scraped the Odeon site for listings and then presented them in a far more accessible, sort of usable version of the site. And of course, a few months later, got a letter from the lawyers telling him to stop. But with the And here it is. Here's odeon.co.uk. Now, if you click in the middle, you get... Oh, that's because I left Grease Monkey on. Without Grease Monkey, you click there and you get nothing. You get a blank screen. But Matthew produced a user script which fixes Odeon's code for them. So here we go, we've hit refresh, and now you're getting the exact same weird little animated things you get in Internet Explorer. And it's fascinating because this is a site that was broken for 3 years. And what Matthew's done is created a patch. So there's a direct correlation to open source. You download a piece of open source software, it doesn't work, and if you've got the time and the skill, you create a patch, you fix it for yourself, and you share it with other people, and send it back to the developers so they can merge it in. And here's the same thing happening again. Matthew patched the site for himself, shared the patch, and if the Odeon people are paying attention, they might even be able to use the code to help them fix their own site. Now, the next example is even more interesting. This is to do with Gmail, Google's webmail thing, which I'll just pull up. So, that's a good idea. There we go. So, Gmail's a very impressive web application. One feature it's missing that you get in certain desktop clients, again, it's not missing because I left Grease Monkey on, is persistent search folders. This, you get this in Apple's latest version of their mail program, and also in Evolution on Linux. It allows you to set up a search as a folder. So it behaves like a normal folder. You click on it and you see all the things, but they're actually search results rather than being things that you put in a folder. So here we go. I turn Grease Monkey back on. If you notice under the green box when it loads up, we now have a brand new box called searches. This has been added by Grease Monkey, even though it sort of fits in with the rest of the Gmail interface. And it comes with its own interface. You click edit. Again, this user interface is all from the user script. And I can create a new personal search, open tech. So I have to search for open tech. And here we go. Not only does it add it into the list there, but if we wait a few seconds, it shows me how many search results match that. So it's a completely new feature, which the Gmail people never envisaged, never supported, and this has been added on in client-side JavaScript. But anyone who's got Grease Monkey can install this and get that new feature in their browser. Final example I'm going to look. Listen, I hope Don likes this one. This is something called Book Burrow, which is it's become quite popular. And this is actually this is the one that won't work with the secure Grease Monkey because of a feature it uses. But here we go. I'll pull up Amazon. And this is the page for the latest Harry Potter book, which seems to be in vogue at the moment. And note that there's a little box at the top, the Book Burrow box, which has nothing to do with Amazon. And if I click the little thing there, it goes out and it grabs the prices from a whole bunch of other book sites. And this isn't just on Amazon. If I go to, say, Barnes & Noble, good old Book Burrow sat there as well. So it's a user enhancement. It saves you the bother of doing price comparisons on five sites because it does them all for you. So here we've got, this is a classic remix. You're remixing data from a whole bunch of different sites. It's all happening in your browser. And anyone who's got this extension and doesn't mind the security problems can install it. Okay, now...
2 minutes outside.
In that case, I'll skip straight over this and go on to the security problems. So there are a whole bunch of nasty things that could happen with Grease Monkey. The most obvious is malicious user scripts. I can put a user script out that claims that adds a new feature to Hotmail, and as an undocumented side effect, steals your username and password and passes it off to me. There are also the potential of sites that fight back. If Amazon decide they don't want these price comparisons, there are steps they could take to try and disable Grease Monkey, and we've looked into this, and there's a whole bunch of sort of backwards and forwards you can go to disable it and re-enable it. Then the real problem, the reason there's a security hole, is API function loops. Grease Monkey gives you a whole bunch of extra functions for your user scripts that normal JavaScript doesn't get, like the one that's used to get data from other sites. The problem is that it doesn't do this securely enough, and it's possible for sites running for scripts running on normal websites to steal these functions. When they do, at the moment, they can steal files off your hard drive due to a rather nasty hole in the HTTP request feature. So just by installing the extension and going to a site, if it was running malicious scripts, it could do all kinds of nasty things. This is all stuff that's being addressed, obviously. So if you're interested in playing around with Grease Monkey, there is a secure version available, and there'll be an even better one in the next few days. You can install it from greasemonkey.mozdev.org. There's a whole site with, there are over 600 user scripts people have shared now, and the number's going up every day, at greasemonkey.com. And if you want to learn your own, Mark Pilgrim of Dive Into Python fame has put together Dive Into Grease Monkey, which is a full online book teaching you how to do them with screencasts showing how to install it and things like that. So I think we're taking questions at the end of the session, but yeah, try out Grease Monkey, it's fantastic.
Now, our final presentation of the day is a follow-up presentation on Grease Monkey, in which I understand that we'll learn a bit more about some specific Grease Monkey applications. And Rob McKinnon's giving this one, and he's plugging in a PC, so the AV equipment will obviously rebel.
Oh, no, it didn't.
Only for Mac, so fantastic at that. Thank you. So, we're already a little bit over time, but we'll still squeeze in some questions at the end, I hope. Donna.
Okay, just before I start, is anyone going to the What the Heck conference in the Netherlands at the end of the week? Oh, great, okay, so I'll see you guys there. That's just a little aside. So, a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago, a friend of mine said, hey, have you checked out Grease Monkey yet? And I was like, what? What's this? And he said, I signed it, it's fantastic, you should check it out. And so that's what I did. First, a few quotes from a book I picked up last year, so probably go, in the last session we had a My Favorite Book site discussion, so I'll probably go up on that website. But one of the ideas talked about in this book is that information is sort of under chains at the moment, and it's great today to hear about the opening of content and access APIs from the BBC, and also just other projects like Gammon's, where documents that are of great social and political importance are being liberated from formats like PDF to bring them to formats like HTML and the web, where people can actually start using them and discussing them and have a conversation around them. And I think that's what these points are making here in the book, that it's really important that information is free and that we be able to actually have our own chances to interpret it and put meaning onto it and have conversations around it. So it's not just that the information is free, but that we have maybe some tools or ways or approaches of using that information. So, Grease Monkey, I think, is one of these little tools in our worksheet that we can use to help free information. It empowers people to share reinterpretations of websites. As Simon was saying, 600 people have already put up scripts for you to share and look at. And also, you know, we've talked about maybe some of the commercial benefits. You can find the best price of a book. But I think there are important social and civic implications of being able to reinterpret web content. Also, part of the power of doing this through GriseMaker is it's quite flexible. You don't have to run a web server. You don't have to maintain a website. It's easy to sort of look at a script and change it to do make it do things you want it to do. And I'm sure that the popular ones are going to propagate, they're going to evolve over time, and I think we're going to see some fantastic user scripts in the future. But ultimately, I guess the contrast is a website is accessible to a wider audience. So I think there's potential there for things that prove successful through a Grease Monkey script in a very flexible, lightweight way that a few users will interact with may turn into websites eventually. Also, there are features that you can implement through running a web server, like persistence of data or keeping records of how people are using things that you can't. Well, maybe we can do it with Grease Monkey, but we'll dive into that at the end of my presentation. Is anyone here from New Zealand? No?
Okay.
Has anyone seen They Work For You or used that? Oh, great. Okay. Oh, well, you're going to get a bit of a kick out of this. I know that my society guys did when they saw this. I've written a little grease monkey script that takes the New Zealand parliamentary record, which is on the web, as HTML. I'll show it to you now. This is the web version of the New Zealand parliamentary record. Obviously very readable, very accessible to people who just want to dive in, have a quick look what was said in Parliament today. So, I've put that smart little monkey on, and let's see what happens. Wow. Now, this is the same web page. And what's great is I'm not having to run a server, I'm not having to maintain it, even though I intend to in the future. I'm actually intending to do it if they work for you, covering the New Zealand Parliament. But this was a great and hopefully productive diversion along the way. So all I've done is, I was fortunate that the HTML was quite well marked up and consistent, so I was able to identify the parts of the page that were that were the names of the MPs, because this is sort of the focal point. So once I had their name, I was able to, I did a bit of background work and found a website that had all the images of the MP, so that was just adding an image into the page. I've made each, the name a link to a page about more information about them. Let's see.
Let's click on something.
If I click here on the name, it takes me to a page that already exists on the parliamentary website, so I'm just linking to their own content. It seems a bit slow because it's a large document, but you get the idea. With a few hours' work, I was able to completely represent this content. So, where could we go with this? Looking through the presentations, I noticed Gavin's definition of a social document, and I think there's probably a number of web pages out there that are social documents, and potentially through GreaseMonkey we might be able to create a conversation around them without having to actually run a separate website. We've got... there's a number of social bookmarking websites that have evolved. One is called Delicious. It lets you make your bookmarks public, and you're able to tag the bookmarks as well in a similar way to the BBC tagging of news stories. So if we could write a little bit of GreaseMonkey, we might be able to go out and grab to see if anyone's bookmarked this page, social document we're on, and if they've tagged it. And we could bring those tags into the document. So we sort of brought in annotation, or not annotation, the tagging of content. Tignorati is a search service that allows you to search blogs to see for a particular URL, you're able to see who's blogged about that URL. So once again, we've got this social document. Perhaps we could go to Tignorati and find out if people blogged about it. And the two could work hand in hand, because in New Zealand there's a handful of bloggers who do political blogging, and they read the New Zealand Hansard. I know they do, because they're talking about it all the time. So once they know there's this tool there that allows them to have their references to the document be brought back into the document through the user script, I'm sure there's probably going to be a much higher rate of actually linking into the document itself. So then we've got the back reference for the commenting. And then we talk about adding a search feature through Google. So you get a lot for not much, really. So it's I think it's a really powerful tool. I think it's very early days. And I think we're definitely going to see some interesting developments going forward.